Well, good evening. It's good to see you. We're small in number, but I hope that won't deter us or discourage us. It's an exciting time. I'm Martin Lown. I'm the acting director of Christian Heritage, founded by Ranald McCauley in 2001 to operate from this church, from the Round Church. So Christian Heritage, been going a number of years now, and familiar faces here. So it's good to see you. This is one of our Life in the Round events. We've done a number of these now, and it's really a chance for unbelievers, with believers, with sceptics, to address some of the big questions of life. I just wanted to mention our next meeting before we get into tonight, which is you have a flyer on your chair, and it's actually Dr. Adrienne Chaplin, Jonathan's wife, who will be speaking on the role of religion and religious images within contemporary art, and that'll be fascinating. A fascinating evening, so that's June the 13th, 8 o'clock in here. It's a Sunday night again. Well, it's an anxious, exciting and unusual time, isn't it, for our nation, politically, economically and in other ways. Very uncertain, and meetings going on continuously through the weekend. Well, so it's a very topical question or subject we have this evening, and we're delighted that Dr. Jonathan Chaplin from the Kirby Lang Institute of Contemporary Ethics here in Cambridge is going to speak to us on the issue of faith and politics, particularly on the title Neither Theocracy Nor Secularism. He'll talk for 40-45 minutes, then there'll be questions, and we'll finish at 9:30. So we're delighted, Jonathan, to have you. You've got one or two things to show us as well, books and papers, and perhaps you could make those available to us. So over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very good to be here. First of all, congratulations to all of you who made it out tonight after saturation coverage of politics for the last 4 or 5 weeks. What is wrong with you guys? Why aren't you at home doing something more interesting? But thank you for coming. Is this... okay. All right. I just happened to notice this little interesting poster with me on one side and my wife on the other. I'm going to take this back to my wife and we'll figure out what interesting things to do with that. I've never seen that kind of thing before, but there you go. Let me get out the crass commercials before I go any further. You've got a brochure about our institute on your seat, so do take that away with you and take another one away. If you can give it to somebody else, you might be interested. We also have some other publicity from our organization. We produce something called Ethics in Brief, a 2,000-word analysis of contemporary ethical questions from a Christian perspective. We've got a couple of samples over there on the pew. So do take those. Those are free. And I also have some books. So again, give the sort of vanity first, but they do relate to this talk, actually. One is called Talking God, The Legitimacy of Religious Public Reasoning. That's available there. That's the hardest thing to sell, not because it's no good, but because you can get it free on the internet. But if you want, you know, the paper copy, £5 over there. And then this book, which I co-edited with Nick Spencer, God and Government, Essays on Faith and Politics, Essays on Political Theology. So do take a copy of that. That's £10. If you want to find out more about the topic I'll be speaking on. Well, as Martin said, this is an extremely interesting and hot topic. And among many of the interesting and curious and fascinating dimensions of the recent election campaign was the sheer volume and intensity of religious participation in the election. Even if you're a hard-nosed secularist, and if you are, you're very welcome, love to hear from you. Even if you are, you couldn't fail to have missed, I think. Certainly if you read The Guardian, and if you look at The Guardian online, comment is free belief, an absolute torrent of comment on the election and related themes. All sorts of initiatives from faith-based organisations, from churches, from diocesan organisations, from ad hoc groupings, making all kinds of statements. Far more, I think everybody agrees, far more than in 2005. There's been a definite step change in terms of at least Christian participation in the political system. For good or ill, let's just leave that hanging for now, just recording that as an empirical fact. Some welcome it, some deplore it, and many others are sort of scratching their heads in between and wondering what to make of this. But certainly it's a remarkable fact about this particular election. And that's partly why I've chosen the title Neither Theocracy Nor Secularism. Because one of the features of recent debate in Britain and elsewhere about the role of religion, specifically Christianity, in politics, is whether there is a way through these two seeming extremes. You know, secularists routinely charge religious believers, particularly the more conservative orthodox ones, with an attempt to, you know, surreptitiously recreate a theocracy. And from the other side, Christian believers, and not only Christian believers, other religious adherents, charge humanists and atheists with a sort of conspiracy to secularize the entire country. And the debate is often polarized between these two extremes. And so I want to try to, in the first part of this lecture, I've got a handout on your on the chairs there, just characterize this tussle that's going on right now and try to make a bit of sense of it. And then in the second section, I want to simply present what I call a Christian view of government. It's a Christian view, it's not the Christian view. Anybody who knows anything about the Christian community and the Christian tradition knows that there are several Christian views of government. We all think ours is mainstream, and I'm no exception, but I'll call it a Christian view, and you know, I'd be interested to hear what you think of it, whether you're a Christian or not. And then the third part asks the question, is this Christian view of government actually a third way? Does it provide a way beyond these poles, these polarities of theocracy and secularism? So let me start then by characterizing the recent debate over recent years over the role of religion in public life. And if you have followed this at all, you'll know that it's a multifaceted debate. And the debate takes place at many levels and about a lot of different kinds of subject matter, from, you know, the admissions policies of church schools to, you know, is Britain being Islamicized, and so on and so forth. There's all kinds of dimensions in this debate. It's not a simple debate, it's a complex debate, as it should be. But here are just a few anecdotal reminders, so to speak, of where the rubber hits the road. From the Christian side and from the side of many religions, there is this perception that in recent years, perhaps particularly the last 10, 15, 20 years, there has been a steady expansion of public secularism, that there is a secularizing process going on, whether intentionally or not, across different sectors of public life. It's not a simple picture because, as I just said, I mentioned church schools. And you know, the Labour government has actually increased support for faith schools in the last 10, 12 years. So that's on the other side of the balance. But on the opposite side, there seems to have been, many people suggest, a steady encroachment of secularist principles, secularist practices, which many Christians feel are sort of pushing them to the sidelines, or silencing them, or marginalising them in some way. Just a few examples here. You may remember a couple of years ago, Archbishop Rowan Williams delivered a very controversial lecture on the role of Sharia law in English law. whatever we make of that lecture, and I'm not going to talk about it, it evoked some striking responses from the side of the secular camp. So just let me quote one. This is Janet Daly in the Daily Telegraph. Daily Telegraph is a pretty religion-friendly rag. That's a deprecating way to talk about the Daily Telegraph, but you know what I mean. So she simply said this: in the contest between principles of modern democracy and doctrines of faith, democracy and the rule of secular law must always win. Categorical statement like that. It's a zero-sum game, and secular law must always win. Back a year, you may remember an extensive debate over the embryology bill that was passed a couple of years ago about involving things like stem cell research and so on and so forth. Well, at that time, Catholic cardinals in Britain intervened in that debate, and they spoke to Catholic MPs as their pastors to remind them of Catholic social teaching on the question, and that they were under an obligation as Catholics to vote according to their Catholic conscience. Well, Jackie Ashley, who, in my view, writes quite a lot of sense frequently, wrote this in The Guardian. If any MP thinks their personal religious views should take precedence over everything else, they should leave the House of Commons. Again, it's a breathtaking, categorical, exclusionary judgment from the side of a secularist, a secular-minded person. In the same debate, at a rather more elevated level, Baroness Warnock, distinguished philosopher, said, quote, "We are not a theocracy, but a democracy. It is Parliament alone that gives law the authority." Now, that was a sort of off-the-cuff piece in the New Statesman. It wasn't a considered philosophical article or anything like that. But to pit theocracy versus democracy like that, again, was strikingly rather stark, as if we had to... All those in favour of theocracy, all those in favour of democracy. Is that the issue? And so these are just a few anecdotes, really, to illustrate how this debate is shaping up. Just last week, some of you may have followed this case. There's a case of a guy called Gary McFarlane, who's a counsellor with Relate, Marriage Guidance Counselling Organisation, national, publicly funded organisation, who lost his request for an appeal against his dismissal because he declined to give counselling, sex therapy counselling, to same-sex couples. I don't know if have you come across that debate. It'll have surfaced somewhere, probably, in a headline or something. I'm not going to talk about the substance of the question. I'm not even going to talk about whether he was right to launch his appeal, or even right to take the stand that he did. We could discuss that in question and answer later on, if you like. I just want to quote from the case, the judgment of Lord Justice Laws. This was delivered just a week ago, actually. I've got the judgment here, just managed to track it down today and have a quick look at it. I've got a couple of quotes from that judgment on your sheet. So here's the first one. So this is a law lord who also happens to be an Anglican and married to a professor of New Testament. That's just a little piece of anecdotal information that you might find interesting. So in the course of this judgment, in which he declined Gary McFarlane's appeal, or right to appeal, in other words, he affirmed the decision of Relate to dismiss him for not being prepared to offer this kind of counselling to same-sex couples. "We do not live in a society where all people share uniform religious beliefs. The precepts of any one religion, any belief system, cannot, by force of their religious origins, sound any louder in the general law than the precepts of any other. If they did, those out in the cold would be less than citizens, and our constitution would be on the way to a theocracy." That's maybe the first time the word theocracy has appeared in the judgment of a law lord for quite a long time. Perhaps it's a first. "On the way to a theocracy, which is of necessity autocratic. The law of a theocracy is dictated without option to the people, not made by their judges and governments. The individual conscience is free to accept such dictated law, but the state, if its people are to be free, has the burdensome duty of thinking for itself." I should have explained that at this point in his judgment, he is responding specifically to the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Carey, who had intervened in the case in defence of Gary McFarlane, in which he made a variety of claims, including that Christianity ought to be the basis of the British legal system, and therefore it had to be considered, religious conscience had to be considered in this case. He said some other things as well, but that was the gist of it. And this is Lord Justice Law's response specifically to Lord Carey. So it's a sort of gladiatorial contest here, almost medieval. We haven't had these sorts of tussles for several centuries, you know, between one of the top legal officers in the country and, well, a former top churchman. It's quite interesting stuff. I will come back to that quote a bit later, but let me just mention here the basic misunderstanding of the term theocracy in this judgment. It's a term that's loosely used in popular discussion, but one expects a senior law lord to use it with rather more precision than this. What he's saying, in effect, is that theocracy is really any example of religiously influenced law. But that's not so. I mean, theocracy literally, like democracy, theocracy means the rule of God, or government by God. Well, literally, of course, that nowhere takes place. I mean, some Christians might say, well, it took place in the Garden of Eden, you know, well, when God walked in the garden and sort of governed the Garden of Eden. Leave that aside. But in any known human history to us, there has never been the direct government of God. What theocracy actually means is government by clergy, or government by clerics, often with reference to some sacred text. Well, where has that existed? Well, arguably you could say a quasi-theocracy exists in a place like Saudi Arabia or Iran. Essentially, Islamic states tend towards a theocratic model. In Iran, for example, although it's a democracy, and in fact Parliament does make the law there, nonetheless there is a Council of Guardians, which consists of senior Islamic clerics, that functions as a kind of constitutional court. So that, you could say, is something approaching a theocracy. It doesn't exist in Britain, and it's frankly inconceivable that it could ever exist in Britain. Actually, it's often thought that the period of history we call Christendom, you know, roughly from 500 to, let's say, well, take your pick, 1600, 1800, that Christendom was the theocracy. But that's also a mistake, historically. In fact, ever since the church emerged in the Roman Empire and in Western Europe, there was always an insistence on a clear duality between two authorities, secular authorities, temple authorities, and ecclesial authorities, sacred authorities. And although that line was blurred often, and although we would draw the line very differently today, nonetheless, Christendom was not a theocratic state at all. It was, in fact, a sort of duopoly, or a dual authority. So no Christian today, certainly not the former Archbishop of Canterbury, is advocating anything remotely like a theocracy. So when anybody uses the term theocracy, one should immediately interrogate it and ask them what on earth they mean. I should say this, though. A number of Christians today, including the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord Carey, do speak, if not of a theocracy, then of a Christian nation. Now, they refer to Britain, sometimes England, as a Christian nation, and want to defend that, and want government to defend that historical tradition. Now, that's not calling for a return to Christendom. What are they calling for? Well, let me come back to that later on in the third section. I just wanted to flag that up as an important qualification there. But my main point here is that there's a great deal of needless alarmism and misunderstandings about the role of religion in politics and the possible influence of religion in government. And unfortunately, a senior law lord just last week has continued to perpetuate those misconceptions. These misunderstandings simply feed their opposite, namely what I'm calling secularism. And now let me turn to examine that notion a little bit. I call it public secularism. What does that mean? Well, the first thing to say about that is that just as certain secular-minded people, including in the case of Lord Justice Law's Anglicans, note the irony there, just as some secular-minded people misrepresent religious influence in politics, so some religious believers misrepresent secular influence in politics. So you tend to get a somewhat caricatured account of what secularists are supposedly up to, or atheists are supposedly up to in politics, as if it's some sort of militant campaign or some sort of conspiracy to, as it were, seize Britain back from Christianity and turn it into a radically secular nation and society. I don't see evidence of any such militant campaign or conspiracy. If there is a secularizing agenda taking place, which I think there is, it's as much by default as by design. There's a small minority, a very small minority of people, I think, perhaps gravitating around the National Secular Society, who have a clear agenda to, as it were, push back religion as far as possible from public life. But, you know, the membership of the National Secular Society, I don't know it, I should have looked it up, but you might want to just Google that and look at what their membership is by comparison to the membership of any religious community in this country. It's pretty tiny. Well, let me distinguish two senses of secularism. The first, I think, is a benign sense. Secularism in the sense of an impartial state, a religiously impartial state. So, for example, the Indian constitution is often described as secular. And what that means is simply that in a multi-faith society with huge religious tensions between Muslims, Hindus, and Christians and others, the state stands back from endorsing officially any religion and adopts a position of impartiality. It's roughly the same model that applies, let's say, on a good day, in the USA. And actually, in spite of the presence of Anglican establishment in Britain, it's more or less what applies in the UK as well. That's a significant qualification that we can come back to later. So that's what I would call a fairly benign meaning of secularism. And in fact, as you'll see, it's one that I can endorse myself as a Christian. But there's another sense of secularism, and let me just quote here a leading secularist writer, Julian Baggini, who's not at all a sort of militant anti-religious secularist. He defines secularism as a situation where, quote, religion becomes invisible at the political level, even when prevalent at the personal level. So secularists like Baggini and others don't mind religion being prevalent at the personal level. They don't mind churches existing. They don't mind Christians evangelizing. They don't mind all kinds of religious activities taking place in civil society or in private life. What they resist is the influence of religion at the political or the public level. And their goal, it's not a conspiracy, it's a stated objective, is to minimize the impact of religion in public policy and in political debate. Well, let's look at that a little bit further. This version of secularism is, I think, based on two assumptions which we need to scrutinize carefully. And I can only give you a sort of taster of what that would involve. The first assumption is this, that secular language or secular reasoning unites people, whereas religious reasoning divides them. This is the basic assumption. If we have religious arguments in public life, society will be divided, which is why we need to appeal to some transcending secular set of reasons in order to bring people together, to produce consensus, to produce understanding and communication. This is often related to the view that religion is somehow uniquely inflammatory or provocative, you know, kind of incendiary, and that it therefore destabilizes democracy. Best to keep it out. We don't need to rehearse the many examples where that is true, and so I won't even begin to do that. You know, we could all cite those, and they're around us all the time, and they're a matter of concern, obviously. But I just want to say this, that it just seems to me that this basic assumption is essentially false, that there's nothing unique about religion that makes it divisive. If you look back at the 20th century and ask the question, what were the most divisive political forces in Europe, let's say? The answer overwhelmingly is secularist ideologies, communism, fascism especially. And they were not simply socially divisive, I mean they led to genocides on a massive scale, way beyond anything that any religious impulse has ever managed to produce. Now, you might think that's an extreme example, but I think it's an important one to throw into the debate, at least. The other side of this is to say that religious influences in politics, actually, historically and today, are often conciliatory. In fact, it's often religious communities that play a significant role, not the only role, sometimes a supportive role, sometimes the leading role, in areas of tension, in urban settings where there are deep social divisions, for example. In international relations, for example, there's also a movement emerging over the last 10, 20 years called faith-based diplomacy, whereby diplomats, both in government and in civil society, positively enlist religious faith, the faith of the people they're dealing with, as a way to overcome barriers, whether they're ethnic or economic or whatever. Divisiveness, I think, has much more to do with tone and manner or related sort of vested interests than it does to do with the content of the arguments being produced. But let me add another sort of caveat here, because I don't want to suggest that that religion, even at its best, is simply about producing consensus. It isn't. And historically, it has actually been a source of political conflict. But is that a bad thing? This raises the question of what kind of democracy we actually want. Do we want a bland democracy where consensus is always, as it were, the immediate objective? The US civil rights movement did not take that view. Martin Luther King did not set about saying, my overriding objective in appealing to my Christian faith is to bring about a consensus. On the contrary, he stoked up serious political division in the cause of justice. In the cause of justice for an oppressed minority in the USA. And he was right to do so. So divisiveness is not in itself a bad thing. Sometimes it's the precondition for the overcoming of serious injustice. And there's no reason why religion shouldn't be part of a movement that produces that kind of campaign for justice, just like secularist movements can do as well. So that's the first reason, the first assumption that I want to question in this public secularist vision. The second assumption related to it is this, that secular speech is rational and objective, while faith-based speech is irrational and subjective. I mean, this is pervasive in public discussion. And again, one can forgive it, as it were. One can forgive this misconception in popular speech or even in, you know, Guardian journalists. But I don't forgive it in Lord Justice Laws. So let me quote the next quotation, which in which he falls right into this mistake, in my view. It's a complex paragraph, and I'm not going to comment on all of it, but you'll get the point. He says this, but the conferment of any legal protection or preference upon a particular substantive moral position on the ground only that it is espoused by the adherents of a particular faith, however long its tradition, however rich its culture, is deeply unprincipled. Actually, he's half right in that sentence, and I'll come back to that later. It imposes compulsory law not to advance the general good on objective grounds, but to give effect to the force of subjective opinion. This must be so, since in the eye of everyone save the believer, religious faith is necessarily subjective, being incommunicable by any kind of proof or evidence. It may, of course, be true, but the ascertainment of such a truth lies beyond the means by which laws are made in a reasonable society. Therefore, it lies only in the heart of the believer who is alone bound by it. Now, that's a rather convoluted way of stating what is widely assumed to be the case in contemporary society, that religious faith is purely subjective. It's a preference. It's an inner opinion or an inner conviction that has no objective verifiability at all. That there's no sort of concrete evidence that can be appealed to, or reasoning, common reasoning processes that can be appealed to communicate it, never mind persuade people of its truth. But this just seems to me simply false. And I think, you know, those of us who want to challenge this view simply have to call the bluff of this kind of argument. And, you know, if some of you share the view that I'm now rebutting, you know, fight back in Q&A. I'm quite happy to have a ding-dong about this. It'll be interesting to see what people think. But this is typically the kind of view, and I'm surprised it comes from an Anglican, actually, although perhaps I shouldn't be. There are many different kinds of Anglicans. It's typically the kind of view that comes from people who have never had any proximity at all to religious faith. I don't blame people for that. I'm simply saying that a great distance from the actual practice of religious devotion, religious community building, religious ethics, religious practice, if you're at a great distance from that, if you have no experience of it, then that is indeed how religious faith often looks. It looks to be just a purely subjective opinion. But actually, I think this assertion is wrong in several ways. For example, Lord Justice Laws says that to non-believers, religious belief is simply subjective. That is often the case, but it's by no means universally true. A lot of secular-minded people recognize the rationality or the reasonableness of Christian faith. This is not something that is a uniform view held among the secularists. It's also not the case to say that religious faith is incommunicable by any kind of proof or evidence. I mean, that's hard to make any sense of, frankly, by somebody who himself is an Anglican. I mean, actually, Anglicanism itself is a broad church, but historically it has held that there are three sources of religious knowledge. There's scripture, there's tradition, but there's also reason. So even Anglicanism itself recognizes that reason and reasoning and rationality is an inherent part of religious knowledge, and that's quite right. I won't say more about that. You may want to pick me up on that later on. So, anyway, it's interesting that this view should appear, you know, just last week from one of the most senior judges in the land. But I think it's fundamentally questionable. So, those two assumptions then, which are the foundations of what I'm calling public secularism, I think we need to question them at the very least. And what I want to do now is try to briefly sketch an alternative view of government rooted in what I take to be the Christian political tradition, which avoids both of those extremes. It avoids both theocracy and public secularism. And let me now try to spell that out necessarily very, very briefly. I'm in section B, A Christian View of Government. I'm kind of summarizing 1,500 years or so of Christian political thought in, you know, what's going to be about 5 minutes, so bear with me as I do that. Well, I've summarized this Christian view in four basic points. Government is legitimate, government is active, government is limited, and government is representative. And let me just say a few things about each of those. So, you know, if you're not familiar with the Christian political tradition, then what I'm doing is simply trying to just open a window on a long tradition of extensive, sophisticated reflection. I do this because often, unfortunately, Christians engaged in politics today tend to short-circuit their own tradition. They're silent about their tradition. They simply pop up from nowhere with a Bible quote saying, you know, we oppose gay marriage, or we want to cancel the debts of the third world, Leviticus 25, you know, or Leviticus 18 in the case of same-sex marriage. Boom, like that, as if that's some sort of knockdown, convincing argument to anybody, never mind the secularists. And that's unhelpful. It shows a lack of knowledge of one's own tradition, a lack of sophistication in political communication. Far better to root ourselves in the best practice of the last 1,500 years. So, four bullet points then, just to try to do that. Back of a postcard summary here. Government is legitimate. In the Christian tradition, it's recognized that government is divinely authorized. That does not mean espousing what came to be known in the 17th century as the theory of the divine right of kings. Some of you you've never known any history, you may have come across that. The Divine Right of Kings was a pervasive monarchical view held in the 17th century and continuing on a little bit after that as well, until the French Revolution sort of swept it aside and cast it into the dustbin of history, essentially. Deservedly so. That is not the Christian tradition. That is actually a heretical departure from the Christian tradition. The whole point about saying that government is divinely authorized is to say that government is a servant of the people. And if you read the New Testament without knowing anything about the prevalent view in the Roman Empire of itself, that is, if you read the New Testament without knowing that at all, you might not pick that up. But even in the classic texts in the New Testament, which speak about government being ordained by God, Romans chapter 13, for example, that's a classic text that's often cited, which says precisely that, government is ordained by God. The thrust of that whole passage is to say that government, and bear in mind, you know, it's the Roman emperor standing behind this scene, the Roman emperor is but a servant of God. Now, that was radical in the Roman Empire. That was a revolutionary claim made in that context. It had never really been heard before. And many biblical scholars are now arguing that this is one of the major reasons why Christians were persecuted in the first few centuries. Not because of the weird private beliefs they had, but rather because they claimed that there was a Lord who was superior to the emperor, and that was a subversive political claim in the context of the Roman Empire. So the government is the servant of the people. The government in the New Testament, and indeed in the Old Testament, this is common to the Jewish tradition as well, is authorized for a very specific purpose. It's not given a blank check. Here's your authority, now it's up to you to go and decide what to do with it and who to dump it upon. Not at all. In the Old Testament, reaffirmed in the New, there are very specific requirements, very specific mandate is assigned to government, which one can summarize very briefly as saying the realization of justice, of just public relations in society, and the promotion of the public good or the common good. And further detail was given both in the biblical text and worked out in the Christian tradition as to what that precisely meant over many centuries. That is the mandate of government. That's what it means to say that government is ordained by God. It means government is ordained to pursue justice, to prosecute injustice, to promote the public welfare in very, very specific ways. And that also functions as a kind of limiting factor on what governments can do, because the point there is that only when a matter of justice or the common good is really at stake, critically, does government authority kick in. The Bible does not give, Christian tradition has never given, a totalitarian mandate to any government. On the contrary, government is always on a very tight leash. And here I need to make one very important point, specifically arising from the New Testament, which of course for Christians is authoritative. I'll talk about the Old Testament in a minute. In the New Testament, there is no suggestion that government has any authority to enforce or protect true religion. Now, sadly, that view was seriously misunderstood in the period known as Christendom, right up to the Reformation, in fact, and after. And there's no question that that was a very serious breach and a departure from the biblical vision, at least from the New Testament vision, for a period of 1,000 years. From which we are still trying to extricate ourselves today, many Christians. But as I read the New Testament, there is no mandate in it for government to either protect or enforce or to define what counts as true religion. Certainly government in the New Testament is to protect the freedom of preaching the gospel. You know, the apostles appeal to that all the time. But that's not the same thing as protecting the inherent content of the doctrines themselves. Come back to that point later on if there's time. So that's the first point. Government is legitimate. Second, I'll move through this very briefly because time is pressing. Government is active and not only reactive. And I put it this way because I want to challenge another widely held misconception about Christian views of the state, which is that Christians sort of instinctively side with what you might call a right-wing or a minimal government view. That is, the least government, the better. Again, this is not the case. If you look back through the tradition, on the contrary, indeed in the scriptures as well, government is not supposed to simply stand back and wait for injustices to take place and then take corrective action. On the contrary, government is given a positive mandate to create conditions of justice throughout society. That's certainly true in the Old Testament, where there's an extensive set of legal and political provisions whereby government is to do precisely that, to preemptively protect people against all kinds of injustice and breaches of their rights. So government's not simply supposed to be reactive, it's supposed to be proactive in that regard. That's all I'll say about that. We move to the third point. Government is limited. Well, it seems to me that in the tradition, there's been a recognition that government is limited in at least four ways. And the first is this: government must be limited by law. That's already true in the Old Testament polity. Again, contrary to many misconceptions, including among many Christians, God did not give... there was actually no powerful centralized authority that didn't emerge till centuries later. Already...